Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Community Geek Podcast. This is Gregory Russo on the cast with Richard Millington.
Hi.
He was fresh off his trip.
Fresh off my trip. I'm temporarily back in the UK, I think you mean.
Yeah, oh man, you move around, Rich. So you're going to be, you were in Lithuania, now you're in the UK. Next week you're going to be in New York? And possibly San Francisco?
Yeah, so let me try and put it together. So I was in Washington with the World Bank like maybe a month ago, then San Francisco 3 weeks ago, Lithuania 2 weeks ago, London this week, then New York for CMX next week, then San Francisco to FormCon the week after, then I'm back home for a month.
I'm not entirely convinced you're like working for MI6, some kind of James Bond like cover.
Do you know what's really bad this time around is that my speaking events clash with the World Cup. So once every 4 years we have this, oh, sorry, it's going to be for a USA audience. Okay, so to people in the USA, this is World Cup, which is like the World Series, but other countries actually participate.
Oh, we know the World Cup. We know it very well.
Oh, I know. I'm just being really sarcastic. So, yeah, I'm going to miss some of the World Cup, which really bugs me more than what I thought I would. Because in the UK, it's such a big event. It's such a big event where the whole country just kind of shuts down. Everyone watches the games together. It's like this really bonding experience. And I've realized that I'm going to be missing most of that, which is annoying.
Well, at least when you're in New York City, I'm fairly confident you're going to be able to find some pubs that are just crammed with expats, like people from all over the
place.
Yeah,
I'm sure, but they're just not my expats, you know.
Well, that could be if you go on the right day. I mean, New York is a really big international city. There's tons of bars, tons of people that are into all kinds of stuff. I think more than any other city in the country, it's probably one of the most diverse. And you know, it has a lot of international businesses. You've got the UN over there. You're gonna find other Brits, I'm sure.
I don't doubt that. Okay, let's get going.
So first up, as we talked about on the last show, we touched on it a little bit. The Huffington Post is currently undergoing a bit of controversy by switching their commenting system from something in-house to basically the Facebook commenting system. If you've seen it on one social networking site, you've seen it on a zillion social networking sites or news sites where you post with your Facebook account and it's got all the usual Facebook doodads like and all that sort of stuff. People are not pleased about this. They were sort of enjoying the fact that they could keep their Huffington Post posting patterns a bit separate from their other online identities, particularly the Facebook one, which, as most people know, you've got family on there, you've got friends from various political persuasions on there, and if you're going to a news site, you're probably commenting on some things that are newsworthy and possibly controversial. There's been an incredible backlash on this. I think Huffington Post is counting on Facebook comments, sort of expanding the pool of people that would comment, but they're definitely doing it at the expense of their core audience, it would seem. Rich, what's your take on this?
I have a couple of thoughts on this. First, I mean, on the surface, it seems like a very dumb idea because they're trying to get people to mix their identities with their Facebook and their Huffington Post. And even though you don't have to connect the two, even though the comments you make on Huffington Post don't have to appear on Facebook itself, even the slightest whiff that this might be happening is causing a lot of concern to the people they're trying to reach. So in one capacity, it definitely does seem to be like something that is going to destroy the community. And it's looking at the number of comments that the current news stories are receiving, and it seems much lower than what it was before they made the change. So definitely there's a big issue with that. Second, though, like I'm sure the Huffington Post knew what this is going to happen. I know that a lot of members of their team, their moderation team, are leaving at the moment. So they must have some idea of what the value of each comment is. And they must not assign the value to each comment to be that high, which is very interesting because that indicates that the value of a comment doesn't really generate that much more revenue for them. So they're quite happy to destroy the comments to reduce the moderation costs, which seems to be what's happening at the moment, and just being happy with the site that they're left with.
But how is incorporating Facebook lowering the moderation costs? I would think it'd be more or less the same. I mean, I've certainly seen no correlation in sites that I've visited between a link to Facebook profile and a reduction in toxic comments. See, people seem more than happy to say all kinds of stuff with their name on it.
Sometimes they are, but I think in this case, because people are more aware of posting using their real identities, they know that the number of comments is going to be much lower. And I think Huffington Post is quite happy to see the number of comments drop dramatically. And there, as a result, there'll be less comments that need to be moderated. And what I've generally seen, and I think there is some data to back this up, but I have to dig it up, is that when people have to be themselves, they're less likely to be as bad as what they would be when they can use any name or any identity that they like. So for now, it's not an identity that we can just put on when we use the Huffington Post, get involved in left-wing political views. And I think that's going to have a big impact. And I'm pretty sure, I mean, the Huffington Post team, they're not dumb. They built this community from scratch. And, you know, I'm good friends with Justin, the former director of the Huffington Post. I know Tim McDonald, the other director of the Huffington Post who left this past week. So I think they know what they're doing. And I think there are financial reasons behind this. And I don't think it's about the quality of the comments or anything like that. I think there's a financial reason behind this. And I think that's what's driving this decision, rather than the desire to have a better quality conversation.
Do you think one of the underlying motives behind that business decision is a change in how they view their site from a community to more of a news site?
Possibly. I just think they're more financially driven. I mean, I don't know what the long-term plans of the Huffington Post are. I mean, I'm assuming that they have some plans. I mean, I know they own other sites like TechCrunch, for example. They're owned by AOL themselves, I think. And I know that TechCrunch also have a lot of issues with their comments. First, they basically implemented a commenting system that told everyone to go away. Then they changed it and told everyone to come back. I think they're trying to become a more serious news site, which is difficult to do when they have a community that is very provocative. A community which they have carefully cultivated to be very provocative. But ultimately, I just don't think that commenting is such a big deal for them. I think they're way more interested in the number of hits that they get. And I think they discovered that people don't come back and comment as often as what we might think. But again, this is all pure speculation. I'm just guessing.
Well, it's definitely something to keep track of. And we've got a...
Absolutely.
We've got a summary post if you want to read a little bit more about it. There's a post up on Community Geek talking about it, and it's I would say it's a story we're going to track because Huffington Post is one of the bigger name communities out there, and it's a really mainstream community in a lot of ways, so I would think it's a story worth following. And we'll see if it pans out or if there's a tie into a larger strategy that maybe sheds light on why they would do this. Moving on, though, we have a interesting event coming into New York City, as Richard touched on.
Yes, we do.
He will be there speaking at it. It's CMX, and I'm personally very excited to read about it afterward and check out some of the videos that they'll be posting afterwards, since fortunately I can't go. But there is a whole contingent of Feverbee heading to CMX, including Richard himself.
There's two of us.
I thought it was three.
No, it's just two.
Oh, well, I'm less excited then. I thought it was you, Darren, and Callum.
No, just me and Callum for this one.
Ah, wow. It'd still be a good time.
So let me talk a little about CMX, because it's one of those events that was created by David Spinks back in February. I think they held their first event around the same time we were pulling the Virtual Communities Summit together. And the first one in San Francisco was a huge success. They had terrific speakers there. They focused a lot upon the psychology of communities. So there's a lot of similarity with what we do as well. And now David Spinks, the founder, who also is terrific and is really good at introducing speakers as well, is doing the same event in New York. So the event is scheduled for June the 11th and 12th, I think, or is it 12th and the 13th? I'll be speaking on the second day. My good friend Natalie Nahaya will be speaking there as well about the psychology of communities. They got Robin Dreek from the FBI. So they got a really good lineup of speakers that are going to be there.
12th, 13th, by the way.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So I think if you're in the area, then you should definitely attend. It's also going to be interesting to see how the conversation evolves from the first event. And it certainly seems like the CMX event is establishing itself as a very good and very prominent event for community professionals in the USA. They've also moved their venue this last week as well, so it's worth paying attention to that or checking the site again if you have signed up to attend.
Yeah, I've been really digging the videos that came out. The speaking presentations for CMX, the last one, were just really good. I mean, really good speakers, really put together topics. The presentations were detailed, but not in a dry way. So I've been regularly featuring them on the site, and I personally can't get enough of them. So I'm looking forward to more. Why don't you talk a little bit about your personal presentation? Because you're going to be one of the speakers this year.
Sure. So I'm going to be speaking about how to make communities more addictive. What we're seeing at the moment is that the success rate for branded communities is horrific. Most of the communities that are started by organizations fail. And it's organizations that tend to spend a lot of money on their communities that still fail. So I'm going to be talking about how we make the types of communities that are very addictive, the types of communities where people want to come back and participate several times a day. I'm going to be talking about the different elements of psychology that are involved in that, such as the initial motivation to get someone to join, how to get good feedback so people participate more frequently, how to make sure everyone in your community feels unique or they feel they have something unique about them, some unique experience or expertise that they can contribute. Because we know the more that someone feels unique within their group, the more likely they are to participate. So it's all these different elements of what makes a community very addictive and how we can create those pieces within the community that we're developing.
How does Feverbee usually recommend that these addictive triggers or addictive designs are implemented in their clients' sites? Because I would imagine this comes up quite a bit when you're doing consulting.
Sure, and it's partly the nature of a social design, and partly the nature of what the community manager individually is able to do. Most communities aren't big enough to make big technology overhauls in the first place, when you can achieve very similar results without spending much money, just by the community manager doing the right thing at generally the right time. So we advise clients to, and it depends very much upon what stage of the platform development process they've gone through. So if they have a platform that has already been developed, making a big change to that is going to cause a lot of issues. So we'll spend more time working individually with the community manager and looking very specifically at the actions that they're taking. What specifically are they saying to each of the members getting to join and to participate? So it's lots of little things like that we spend a lot of time on and make sure that by the end of it, the organization has like all the skills, all of the knowledge and the resources that they need to continue developing that community after we've gone.
All right, I'm really going to look forward to your video. How long do the is it fairly quickly posted afterward, the presentation videos, or?
I don't know. I think they are sponsored by Brightkite, so it depends on them. But I know that it's streamed live, but I think it's recorded as well. So, yeah, I have no idea, to be honest.
All right, well, keep your eye out. If you miss it, definitely expect to see some of those videos being featured on our Friday highlighted video segments, because I imagine they're going to be fantastic.
Oh, and also the next week in San Francisco, there is ForumCon.
Are you speaking there as well?
I am indeed. So ForumCon is an event for people from more of a amateur forum hobbyist kind of background. The kind of people that are using vBulletin, PHP, BB, MyBB, Discourse, Vanilla, and all those sorts of forum platforms. And that one's going to be very interesting. They're using a slightly different approach this time from what they have in the past. And I'm quite excited about it. I think it's going to be a very popular event.
Yeah, I fall into that category of people that use vBulletin, and I can't stand it, but it's probably the best that I can do right now for the community that I run on the side.
It's a really old platform.
And it shows.
I
It
think,
does.
yeah, and I think with vBulletin and MyBB and all those competitors, they have had years to get this right. They've had years to do a big update, and for a long time there was no competition really whatsoever. But now we have Moot that's coming along, now we have Discourse and that's coming along, now we have Pro Boards and that's coming along, and even Vanilla to some extent. All these platforms are now coming along and offering something that's much more advanced, much more integrated, just looks and acts much better than any other site. And I think over the long term, the popularity of these forums will decline quite quickly, and they'll be obsolete within about 2 years, I think.
Well, we'll see if that comes to pass. I really like Discourse. There's been a big discussion about Discourse going on in the Community Geek forums. I've taken a look at it, and it looks really, really good. Like, really good. I mean, it's clean, it's modern, but it's also very feature-rich and compared to vBulletin. I mean, I haven't looked, obviously, at the administrative side of it, but vBulletin's admin page is like a fairly bit of a nightmare if you want to do anything more than just edit a member. So I can't imagine it's any worse.
Yeah, Discourse is what you would develop if you were developing a community from scratch right now. And I think it's going to be something that is ever more popular in the future as well. They have to adapt it and test it a little bit more and add new features to it and decide how they're going to make money from it. But the thing that I'm quite certain about is that they have the best technical team in the business at the moment. And I'm a big fan of betting on the best teams to develop the best technology. And looking at what Jeff Atwood and the team there have developed, I think that they're going to be terrific.
All right, moving on to our final story. I'm sure you guys have heard in the news about a bit of a tragedy. Some young girls stabbed some people.
Yeah.
Allegedly because of the Slender Man meme. Or at least that's what seems to be the trigger. I personally doubt that any specific video game, movie, picture on the internet, etc. really drives people over the line to kill. I imagine they had some fairly serious pre-existing issues. But nevertheless, yeah, you know, the media will do what it does, and basically, somehow, something awful is getting a lot of flack for this murder, which...
Yeah, it's one of those stories where you try to explain it, and the first response is going to be, what? Because it doesn't quite make sense. Okay, so last Saturday, two girls in Wisconsin stabbed a classmate of theirs 19 times to satisfy a internet character known as Slender Man, which is a scary figure created back in, I think, June 2009 on the Something Awful forums. Slender Man is basically a horror figure where you put a scary, thin-looking person, usually in a suit, in the woods or somewhere like that, and it's a scary meme. That's been going around.
It's like an urban legend.
I don't even think it's an urban legend. I think it's no one thinks, I mean, except for these two girls, I guess, no one thinks that it's actually a real thing, a real entity that's in existence. But I think the media are relatively blameless from this because the girls allegedly had said that they did it because of the Slender Man meme. So
yeah, but they're also this, 12.
They are also 12, but I mean, I don't think that. I'm not saying that Slender Man. I'm not saying that they don't have a lot of issues anyway. Clearly, as Something Awful and Eric Parsons and the team have said, you know, it's ridiculous to think that this is solely because of Slender Man. But there are lots of tragedies involving online communities, and Something Awful is being involved in a few of these things in the past. But what's interesting about this one is the way that Eric responded to it. And he wrote a post that was published yesterday due to the media attention that they were getting. And it's something like, please don't kill anybody because of Slender Man. And it was very sarcastic. And I felt it got the balance exactly right to try and put some perspective to everything that was going on at the moment. Because clearly Something Awful is not responsible for this situation. I don't think that they have any responsibility within this particular situation. And they're trying to put some real perspective on what's going on at the moment. And I think that the response and the words they actually used was very clever And I think they nailed what they had to say. So whilst we can all agree that this is a tragedy to some extent, well, I mean, well, there's no doubt that it is a tragedy, but to think that it's because of something awful, I mean, it's just a crazy situation. Having said that, it does put a bigger spotlight upon what the responsibility is of community professionals for what happens as a result of that community. And that's a very interesting discussion that I don't think we're having just yet.
I think it goes even a bit more beyond. The girls said they read about it on an entirely different website. So this was an idea that originated in one community, spread to multiple.
Sure.
I mean, there are lots of ideas like that, probably a lot more mundane than Slenderman. But, you know, anything like that, whether it's an idea, a movie, a novel, to what extent does the originator hold responsibility? I mean, it was created on something awful 5 years ago, and it's become very widespread throughout the net. In this case, the girls found it on Creepypasta, which is sort of a, I don't know.
It's a story, right?
It's a story. It's more like an archive / curated collection of all these internet urban legends, of which Slender Man is possibly the first, definitely the most famous, but far from the only one. There's one called The Rake I know of, which is a figure with like really long nails that like cuts people up and stuff. There's so a legless woman that rides around, you know.
Okay, we get it. So I have some thoughts on this. I don't think that the community professional or the community manager or the founder of that community are responsible for anything they could have realistically stopped. So I think, for example, when there's the Boston shooting a year ago and the Reddit community went crazy, tried to identify the missing person and eventually named the wrong person as the suspect, I think Reddit had lots of time and opportunity to realistically stop that, and they didn't, and I think that they should have done. Having said that, I think when one member does something outside of that community, I don't think they have any level of responsibility towards that. And it's a very gray line, and I fully understand that. But I think we need to be a little bit realistic. We know that the media, at the best of times, because it's the internet, because it's something that's relatively new and we don't quite understand it, they're very keen to point the finger at any situation whatsoever. But I think realistically, you have to think, was there an opportunity when it could have been stopped? And in this case, I don't think there was. I don't think there was, and I think if it wasn't this, it would have been something else. When a shooter back in 2007, I think, was asking for advice about guns on the Something Awful forums before he committed the act, I think then, yes, they do have some responsibility. There has to be a process in place for when they can identify those sorts of discussions. And that's very difficult when you have millions and millions of discussions. But as we know, with great power comes great responsibility. So there has to be some sort of process in place for that. But I know it's a very gray line. So
well, that identification can be really difficult. I mean, if you have a section for firearm discussion on your forums, you know, if one of those people says, hey, I'm thinking about getting a new handgun, would you recommend this one or this one? That could be a very legitimate discussion. If that person then takes the advice of which gun to purchase and then goes and kills someone, it may not be very clear from the post that there's something strange about that. I mean, in the Slender Man case, it was a concept that had no connection to real people committing murders at all. So why would you think about stopping it? Whereas on the Reddit side of thing, you know, pointing the finger at somebody without due process and getting basically an online lynch mob together, that can, you know, that has pretty clear real-life consequences that can be directly seen and are somewhat implied. Whereas most of the time when you're doing community discussions, it just doesn't have that aspect to it.
But in the case of the buying guns, if they're legitimate questions and there's no way that we can possibly foresee the consequences of that, then I fully get that. When people are asking about how to kill themselves, for example, then clearly there's a line that has to be drawn at some point. It's more difficult in cases like 4chan, where there's no moderation whatsoever. Everything is deleted after, I think, 12 or 24 hours. So in communities like that, how do you stop something bad happening? Or maybe it doesn't, because it vanishes just so quickly. And I don't think we've had a good enough debate about that yet. And if there's one thing that we could benefit from at the moment as a result of the Slender Man attacks last Saturday, it would be to have that sort of debate to figure out what we are realistically responsible for. So if we're developing a community of hate, if we're trying to ignite that sort of hatred against any particular group or any particular individual, then any consequences of that, then we have to be responsible for. Because I think we have a level of responsibility there. But drawing the line and having those processes in place is just going to be so difficult. But we have to do it, because otherwise there's a danger that our work inadvertently could cause real harm to people, even if we don't mean it to.
I think you're right. That's an important conversation to have. I just don't think this particular situation really falls into that category. I think we should have that discussion regardless, though. Because, as you said, it's extremely important. So.
But here's a more interesting question for Something Awful Now. What do they do? Would they leave references to Slender Man there? Would they let other people see it? Would they try and stop 12-year-old girls from accessing their community, even though they didn't this time? But theoretically, what can they do at this point in time to stop that happening again? Or maybe they just say, this isn't something that we're responsible for, so we didn't have to do anything. But you get the feeling, if something happened again, say if there was another attack in a couple of weeks' time from people that had read about Slender Man on the Something Awful site, you have to feel that that the finger would be pointed at them, fairly or unfairly, and I think they might have to consider taking steps to prevent that, even if they think that they're in the right.
I don't know. I think it's been around for 5 years. The girls didn't even have a direct connection to Something Awful. Something Awful is a paywall community, so you must pay a fair bit of money to even get into it. So I imagine they already have policies and procedures in place to sort of identify and possibly weed out minors. I know the media is making the connection because this is where the meme originated from, but I think it's fair to say the Slender Man meme has created a life of its own, and it's become part of the larger internet lexicon. And I think Something Awful has enough attitude and enough disregard for authority to just, you know, say, tough it, it's not our fault. If you want someone to do something about this, you need to be looking in a different direction, because we didn't really have anything to do with it. We didn't have any power to stop it, and we're not going to have any power to stop a similar situation like a copycat in the future. But maybe they will say that we do support that being done. It's just not something we have a responsibility or a capability to do.
I think that is that if it does happen again, I think that they will be right in saying that it's not their fault. And I think that they will lose the argument as well, just because the pressure of the press and the parents and the publicity, I think it will just become such a big issue that it can crush a site like theirs. That's my thoughts. And I don't know what I would do if I was managing that community now. But I think what they've done at the moment is very bold, and I support it. But I'd be thinking very carefully about what happens if this happens again, and what meaningful measures can we put in place now to say we took all the meaningful measures that we could. Anyway.
I think if that question's going to be asked, it should be asked of Creepypasta, which is where these girls found it. Maybe that's the site that needs to have better, you know, better screenings to make sure young kids aren't reading that kind of stuff. If anything, I think, I mean, that's the source of it. Really, it's the Something Awful's fault.
For sure. And I don't think that is Something Awful's fault, but I just think that the media won't care. I think that the press won't care. I think that politicians would not care. I think it will just be such a populist rage. And there'll be so many other things that people could pick up on that the focus will inevitably turn to Something Awful. And that's why I think they have to put something in place now. I think they have to try and think of something that they can do. So if anything ever happens again, they can say that we had certain policies in place to stop this sort of thing happening. And I have no idea what they might be, but I think they have to be thinking about that. because it's not about winning the it's not about being right. It's about being able to say or being able to persuade the press and the media and a lot of other people that you're right, which is what I think might trip up a lot of other communities as well.
Yeah, I think you're right, but something awful has, it's not happening in a vacuum, right? Something awful has a bit of a reputation, and they have a very distinct culture where they could care less about other people's opinions of them. So they might get skewered in the media, but I'm almost positive it wouldn't be the first time. And I think they're probably going to be quite happy to be the villain if they feel themselves that they're justified. Whether or not that'll have any impact on the growth of the community, who knows? But it's a pretty stable, long-lasting community that survived a lot of controversy. So I would be surprised if this is the thing that breaks.
We will see.
All right, guys. Thank you very much for tuning into the Community Geek Podcast. This has been Greg and Rich. And I will be back next week. Richard will be indisposed
for a couple of weeks, indeed.
But we'll hopefully have Mike back on the show, fill in for Rich, and bring you the latest in community news. Have a great week, everybody.